good afternoon. So last time we started out by talking about the two-phase assignment, how that would work in the assignment, some things that, you know, were kind of just special cases in the assignment to keep things simpler. Then we look at this other topic of protection and security. So you mentioned protection is a term we use for operating systems about mechanisms to control access to things. And a lot of things we've actually seen before are protection mechanisms. So page tables are a protection mechanism for memory because they prevent processes from accessing physical memory that isn't assigned to them. They control the access to physical memory, and by setting up the page tables, operating systems can implement policies that, you know, say what data in memory a process can access. And we call sort of policies that prevent bad things, sort of, that's what, you know, our security goals are. And a common thing we'll want to do is we'll have some sort of thing, like a file, that the operating system will manage, and we'll want to control what programs have access to it. And a big abstraction we'll think about for this is this access control matrix idea, that we can say we can have all our files, you know, crossed with all our potential ways of identifying programs, which we call protection domains, and say, you know, given that intersection of each one, what things are allowed? What, for each file and type of program, what things can it do to that file? And same thing might be, we would ask not just for files, but say for processes and other things that, you know, you can do operations on. And our operating system can implement this kind of abstraction by having checks when we access files and other objects, where it's going to look up what's in this matrix and say, okay, your process is running in this domain, therefore it is allowed to read this file or it is not, and control, for example, what open does. Now, as for actually storing our information about what programs are allowed to access what, we could store kind of this matrix kind of explicitly. We could have just a file, you know, so some list somewhere that says, you know, this user, this file can read. More typically, we'll have lists called access control lists stored alongside our files or other objects programs are trying to access. And we saw that POSIX has a, you know, two versions of this, one of which is pretty much always implemented on a Unix system, and one of which usually, maybe some of the time, is there. And so the basic version is we have an access control list, but it's sort of very limited. We specify a user, a group, and for each of those, we specify what operations they're allowed to do, and POSIX has decided that the operations we can enumerate are reading, writing, or executing. That, if you wanted to be more specific, well, too bad. That's the ones we've decided. And POSIX also has more complete access control lists where we still specify whether we want reading, writing, or executing, but we can specify a list of as many users as we want and what we allow them to do, as many groups as we want and what we allow them to do, and so on. And since these access control lists are specifying users and groups, how does that work? Well, we have IDs assigned to each user and group. Processes have those IDs tracked by the kernel, and the kernel can check those IDs versus the access control list when you try to access things. We mentioned to actually implement this, we want to enforce those checks in system calls. It's very important that this is not some sort of advisory thing that's done. It has to be something the process can't bypass, and if it's not in the system call, well, the process can bypass it by making a system call that doesn't do the without doing the check first. But if it's in the system call, well, the only way you can open a file is by asking the kernel for help. And if that function you have to ask for help checks these things, it's going to ensure there's no way around it. So then we talked about issues of how do we sort of set up the system and deal with some certain important special cases. And one thing we have on a Unix system is we have one user ID that's very special called superuser with user ID 0. And what we do for this user ID is we just have a special case in all our permissions checks where, regardless of what the access control list says, we're just going to say, yes, you're allowed to do that. And this means that a program running with user ID 0 can do things like change its user ID to something else. That's something we'll allow. And this is typically how the program that you log into is going to work. That it's going to run with the special user ID 0. It asks you for your username and password. It has some way that whoever wrote that program decided to check your password. We learned that typically there's some file that ordinary users can't read that stores those. And if it matches, it's going to change the user ID to your user and run your shell. And then we said, okay, so that handles logging in. We also have other cases where we seem to be able to do privileged things. So one thing is that you may have used a tool called sudo, which you're running as a normal user. You run this sudo command, it asks you for a password, and suddenly it runs something with these extra privileges, typically as the super user user. So how does that work? And we learned that the mechanism for that was this idea of set user ID programs, that there's a bit that's stored with every executable that can be set to true. And if it's set to true, the exec call, when you run that executable, is going to run it not as the user ID that called exec, but as the user ID that owns the file, that is the user ID listed in that file's sort of limited access control list. And sudo is such a program, so it can run with super user permissions, and it can decide what to do based on that. And what it typically decides to do is it like checks for a password, checks if you're allowed to do things, and if so, does them for you. So questions about things we covered last time? Okay. So we mentioned that this idea of the set user ID programs kind of give us a way to make decisions about what users are allowed to do outside the curve. That, you know, we can, for example, allow any user to restart the system, even though the kernel may have made the decision that there's a restart system call and it's only allowed for user ID 0. But we can write a program that's marked as set user ID, runs as user ID 0, and restarts, and allow any user we want to run that program. Those users can restart the system now. But those users shouldn't have access to all the other things that user ID 0 can do. So in this kind of way, the set user ID programs allow us to sort of choose specific things we want users to do, even though the kernel may not have a mechanism otherwise for us to specify, oh, no, for restarting, please allow, you know, the administrator and this user to do it. You know, the kernel doesn't have that mechanism explicitly, but set user ID programs sort of let us do that. And on a typical Unix-like system, there's actually a lot of uses of set user ID programs. Sort of maybe one of the more common ones is if we think of like mounting a sort of USB stick with a file system. This is typically something that's going to involve a set user ID program. The reason why is, well, there's a call to set up a file system. But we don't want to allow just any user to do that, because setting up a file system could mean that you mess with the main file system. But if we want to allow the user sitting in front of the machine to mount sort of an external drive, we need to have sort of an exception for that. And the typical mechanism for that is we'll have a program that's going to allow you to mount things, but it's only going to allow you to mount things that are these removable devices. It's not going to allow you to disrupt how the main file system is set up. Even though the system call that it's going to make to do this is just going to check, are you a system administrator? It's not going to have a notion of, you know, is this something that normal users can set up or not? But this program that we run that's installed by the system administrator can do that. And it can also enforce sort of other restrictions. It can say, you know, I will only set up the file system in a way where you can't have set user ID programs in it. Or I will only set it up in a directory, specific directory, so we don't mess up other directories. We also might imagine using this for sort of talking to specific devices, that we might not want to allow every user to directly talk to the printer, but we can have a special program that runs with extra permissions that does that, and it can enforce things like that we don't send invalid junk to the printer that's going to make it spit out 1,000 pages. Because we who wrote that program control that, even though sort of the operating system kernel doesn't know how to do that. All it knows how to do is send stuff to the printer. It doesn't know what that means. It doesn't know if that's going to like make the printer spit out 1,000 pages. And in this sort of way, we can think of set user ID programs as kind of sort of analogous to system calls. So with system calls, what happened is that the hardware decided that some things only the kernel can do. And the kernel said, well, I want to allow programs to do it, so I'm going to make a system call to allow them to do it. In the same kind of way, often on our existing operating system, the kernel has decided some things only special users can do, like super user can do, or some other special user. And a set user ID program lets us say, no, I want to allow users to do that, so I'm going to give them a way of doing it in the same kind of way. So questions about set user ID programs, sort of generally how they work. Yes? Can I explain the particular port number? So something we didn't mention when we talked about ports this semester is that a common policy is that ports less than 1,024 are reserved for special users. So in a shared system, you know that if you're contacting the port less than 1,024, it's authorized in some way. Other questions? Yeah. Question is, when I log out of the system and I have to mount a USB stick?
So after you log back out of the system, then you have to re-authenticate the next time you log into the system. So if possible, logging out, does it say you use it?
So the question is, how does this mounting USB stick interact with logging in and logging out? So if we have a program that does this, we are going to log in normally. We're running with our user ID. I'm going to run this program. Or something, something's going to run this program to request, on my behalf, please mount this USB stick. And it's going to make a system call to say, set up this new file system here. It's OK. And that system call is going to be one that we don't allow normal users to do, because if the new file system is like the main hard drive, that could mess things up a lot. So it's going to make that system call. And as for what happens afterwards, well, unless that program is like monitoring whether we're logging out or not, probably it's going to stay set up. That program could monitor if we log out and like have a case where it like undoes it, but that would be the responsibility of the program, like because the kernel doesn't actually know why it's being mounted. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yeah. How does the OX distinguish between the executable flag and the set UID flag? They are just different bits, and typically stored in the inode. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay. So I think I alluded to when I finished up last time that you should probably that I've told you how useful set UID programs are, set user ID programs, and you should never write one. So why should you never write one? So let's go through a hypothetical use case for a set user ID program. So let's say I have a directory on a shared server with a bunch of grades. And for each assignment, I have a folder. In that folder, I have a text file with the user's grades. And I could try to set access control list entries for each of these text files so users can read them, but that's a lot of work. So my idea instead is I'm going to write a program where you type print grade assignment. It's going to look at what user ID you're writing as. There's a way of looking up. And it's going to print out the appropriate file. And I'm going to make this set user ID to some user which can read all the grades. But it's OK because it should just be only reading the one for the user who ran it. So here's a hypothetical program to do that. And this program is extremely buggy. And in particular, there's a whole huge number of ways that an adversary can make this program do things that are not intended. Can someone give me some examples? Yeah. Passing a faulty argv. So what would be faulty about our argv?
I'm not really sure, but I mean, it
So can someone be more specific about that? There are indeed arguments which would cause some problems here. Can I just pass a pointer to any grade in the folder that I want? So an argv main? So argv is going to be used to format a string here. So it's not so super straightforward, right? Because the string that this formats is going to have some other stuff after it. Yeah?
It looks like the directory is being passed in as an argument, whereas the file in the directory is like the user's ID that's found in the environment.
Yes, OK. And what about that? So pass an idea which is not yours, where? As the?
As an argument.
As an argument? So this argument is supposed to be the assignment name.
Oh, the assignment name.
Yeah. So yeah, what we're going for is assignment, then user.
Okay.
But there is something with that. Okay, yes.
Were you getting at that you could pass in whatever you wanted in the environmental variables?
Was I getting at you could pass whatever you want in environmental variables? Not explicitly, but that is a problem. So this getENV function, you might wonder, what does this do? So getENV is there's a bunch of environment variables. And whoever wrote this said, oh, well, user environment variable set to the current user, so I can just use that. But the way the environment variables works is that these are key value pairs that are copied from the prior process, copied by execv. So they're just copied from the prior process by execv. The prior process can set these to whatever they want. These, you know, so this is not this, you know, this can be changed separately from the current user, effective user ID. So just because I can change that user variable to anything, it's just a key value pair in the process that's just copied automatically. So the environment variables are just, so I can just change the user to whatever I want. So what I wanted to do instead here is I wanted to instead use, you know, UID, sort of get UID plus lookup in the database, name in the DB. So instead, I'm supposed to look up a user ID from that the kernel tracks, which I can do, it happens with get UID, and look up a name in a database. But that's not obvious, and this would usually work, except that someone could just set the user environment variable to make that work, and just setting environment variables is things you can just do, because they're just key value pairs that are stored with your current process. They're not something that the kernel actually limits. Okay. So another problem here is that argv1 here, this assignment name, I have some interesting assignment name proposals. I like the assignment name ...... you know, instructor secret stuff / you know, so I can make some assignment names which maybe don't access any of the intended files. So that's another problem. There's one more, yes. Yeah, open's being called with the write flag, but that doesn't. How could that be? Do something bad?
Well, it's not closed.
It's not closed. Well, so it happens that exiting closes things, so that's okay. How could that be bad? That's a good point. Yes, open's being called writable, but how could that be a problem? Yeah. What? So the file descriptor can be read or written, but there's what code here would actually write to it? This is probably the trickiest thing that's wrong here. There's something simpler. I'm surprised no one who's taken like 3710 has pointed out.
Would you redirect the standard out to point to that file name, and since it's open with the write flag, you could just write it into the file and change it?
Question, if I redirect the standard out to put in the file name. So if I redirect standard out, I have to open the file to redirect. So that wouldn't do it. But what I can do is I can run this with standard out closed. And the way open assigns file descriptors is it assigns the first available file descriptor. So if standard out's closed, when I call open, open's going to return file descriptor 1. And then when this printf happens here, it's going to print to file descriptor 1. So by executing this with file descriptor 1 closed, I can cause it to print out to a file I specify. Does that make sense? Questions? Yeah.
How does that help us if we're still just reading a fixed size out of
the... How does that help us if we're still just reading a fixed size out of things? So if opening this file, we're reading a fixed size out of it, we're disrupting the file in some way. So whether that's good or we're corrupting the file in some way, whether that's useful to the attacker or more than just being disruptive is a trickier question. Yeah. What is file descriptor 1? So by convention, standard in is file descriptor 0, standard out is file descriptor 1, standard in is file descriptor 2. But answer your question? This came out in the shell. Yes. What happens if I pass an argc as 0? So if I pass an argc as 0, or maybe as just 1, in that case, argv of 1 will be some sort of array out of bounds thing, which will probably just crash. But there's something I'm surprised no one who's taken 3710 has mentioned. Well, I assume someone here has taken 3710, yeah? Can there be a buffer overflow? Absolutely. File name is 500 bytes. This sprintf can print much more than 500 bytes to file name. So we also have a buffer overflow, which can overwrite lots of things. And if you take 3710 alone, maybe that could cause other problems, depending on how this code is set up. So we have a huge amount of stuff which can go wrong here. And a lot of it is because we have to worry about things which you never worry about in normal programs. What if this program is called and standard out isn't open? Right, that's something you never worry about in a normal program. What if the environment variables are set to something weird? That's never something you worry about. What if argc is 0? What if, you know, there's other environment variables some things might use? What if there's memory corruption? These are all things which are huge problems for a set user ID program and mean that it's extremely difficult to write one that is secure. The pseudo people have done a pretty good job. There have been some problems, but it's not something I recommend doing unless you do a lot of research about what you're doing, because there are lots of things which can go wrong. Yeah.
Where would anyone actually write a set user ID
server program? Someone has to implement sudo. And the program that mounts things, and often the program that displays things on the screen is set user ID, because sometimes those devices require root. There's a surprising number of cases where we have set user ID programs in practice. And I would say it's tractable to do it, but there's a bunch of things you have to worry about, like environment variables and file descriptors being closed, and not trusting any paths that you take in that is not like normal programming. Yeah? Can I explain what the environment variables are? So on a Unix system, with every process, there's a bunch of key value pairs which store things like, store information for convenience of programs. That information includes the current username so they don't have to look it up. It includes like the list of where we search for programs. So remember when we implemented the shell, we didn't actually search for where ls is. But the way a normal shell would search for ls is it uses the path environment variable to figure out where it is, for example. Does that answer your question? But the environment variables are key value pairs that are just set by a program and just preserved when the program executes a new program. Yes? Why is .dot.slash.dot.slash.dot being bad again? If we have that inserted in here, it will access things outside the all grades directory. If we can name a file that's actually outside the directory, it will open it, if we can open it. And we could potentially do that if there's some directory of, you know, with student name.txt in it. That would be pretty easy. Yeah?
How can we change the key value pair that's returned by get
environment? How can we change the key value pair that's returned by setting get environment variable? So there's a library call called, I guess, most simply, putenv. So if you do something like putenv, you know, user equals something, and then you exec v. In that process, you exec v, getenv user will return that something. Does that answer your question? Yeah. What does printf do? Sprintf is like printf, except instead of writing to the terminal, it writes to this variable. Does that answer your question? Okay, yeah. What's the difference between cprintf, sprintf, and all the other printfs? So cprintf, so in XV6, the printf that you used in user programs, unlike the normal cprintf, the printf in C, I should say, required you to pass a file descriptor argument. The printf you had in the kernel was called cprintf because it always went to the console, C for console. In normal C, there's a printf function which goes to standard out, there's a fprintf function which goes to a specified file, and there's a sprintf function which goes to a specified string variable. What's the difference between a string variable and a file? A string variable is a character array. A file is something you get from fopen in the case of the C standard library. Other questions? Yeah? The question is, how does sprintf has a format string here which has placeholders with %s. So we put argv1 in the first %s and getenv user in the second %s. Does that make sense? Other questions? Okay, so I mentioned why you should never write a set user ID program. There's just lots of things to worry about. Yes, it's possible to do, but this is not something you should do and assume it's going to be secure, because it probably isn't. So another thing that comes up a lot when we're thinking about set user ID programs and programs like it is, you know, assuming we've handled all these issues with making sure, you know, we aren't running with a weird environment, sometimes I want to do things sort of on behalf of the user that aren't supposed to be privileged. So for example, if I have a program that's printing something, maybe it's marked set user ID because the printer is not something we just allow any program to access. One reason for this is if we want to enforce print quotas, if we want to make sure a user can't just print out 1,000 pages, well, we could have a program that counts how many pages you print out and doesn't let you print out too many. And let's say this program takes a file to print on the command line. Can that program just open the file? And we have a problem here, which is the answer is, well, not really, because if they just open the file, then you can print files that you're not supposed to be able to access. And we're not supposed to allow that, right? The purpose of this program is to allow you to print things that you can access. It's not to allow you to print other people's files. So an idea we might have to enforce this is that we might say, have a check in the program. If the original user can read the file, open the file, print it, close it. Problem is that there's a race condition here, and this won't work. And what the race condition is that I can, you know, create a file that's a normal file to print. The program checks, can I access that file? Yes, I can. Then I replace that file with a link In this case, link will make a hard link. Remember we mentioned with inodes that you could have multiple hard links to a file. If I didn't have support for that, I could also use symbolic links, which would be the same thing with symlink. But in any case, there's ways of making aliases for files. So I can make an alias for a file I'm not supposed to access with the same name. And that alias, well, I can't open it. I can make the alias because I control this directory, but I can't actually open the file. Ordinarily, this is perfectly fine. But the problem is that if I set user ID program, it said, yes, you can access the file, the original file, and then it opened the alias for that file I'm not supposed to be able to access. And it's going to print it. So questions about sort of this timeline I have here? Yeah. So the thing is, so originally we can open it, so the program's check is correct, yes, and then the other program makes it an alias for something that program's not supposed to access. Is that, yeah. Yeah. So it makes an alias. So the link system call in POSIX makes a new hard link to a directory. So it just adds a directory entry pointing to a specific inode, basically. And ordinarily, this isn't a security issue because whether you can access the file through that directory entry is going to depend on the permissions on the file. So you can make a new directory entry for a file that you can't read, and you still can't read it. That's how it's supposed to work. But the problem is now, I can read it because I fooled this other program into thinking, oh, that's a normal file. Does that answer your question?
Does this just apply to anything, though? Like, you could do this with any file?
Question, I could do this with any file? The constraint is I need to be able to, like, remove a file from the directory it's in and add a new thing. But other than that, yes. So as long as I have a directory I can change things in, I can do this. This attack. Other questions? Okay, so this type of problem, and I mentioned I'm doing it with this link command, which makes a new directory entry for a particular inode. We can also do it with like renaming files. If we can rename a file we're not supposed to read, if we can make other types of aliases, or maybe I can run a program that creates a file with a particular name I can guess. So I create the file with that name, run print, then run that program very quickly, and make it actually access that file that another program created. A classic example of this would be if our password changing program like made a temporary file. We could use this, we could try to guess the name of that file and pass it to the print program. So this type of problem is known as a time-to-check to time-if-use vulnerability. The problem is that when we're checking if the user is allowed to access things, and when we're actually accessing it for them, those are different times. And therefore, they have different results. And this actually seems very difficult to avoid because, you know, I've done the best I can in this code as far as checking if the user can open it and opening it. I had the minimum amount of time. But there's still a potential problem. So what's a solution for this? And the most common solution is that we want some way of becoming the original user. And this is why, when I talked about getting the current user ID from a process, it was called the effective user ID. So POSIX supports multiple types of user IDs, primarily for the purpose of allowing a set user ID program to temporarily switch back to the original user to do things like open a file that the original user is supposed to have access to, but not necessarily, you know, files they aren't supposed to. So you can use these extra user IDs to sort of swap out the effective user ID for the original one, open the original file, then swap back your extra privileged user ID. And in this way, we don't have the problem because the open operation is going to use the correct user ID, and And it's going to be checking the permissions in the file at the same time as it opens it, so there's no gap. There's no time I can change it. If I change what the file is, I'm not opening the right file. The file I'm trying to, as an attacker, to open. So questions? This idea? Yeah.
How exactly does swapping out the user ID
solve the problem? So in this code, what we'll do instead, so we'll swap out the user ID, and then this open, it will see the new file, the secret file, and fail, or we'll see the old file, so the old normal file, and work, but we're just opening the normal file. So there's not a possibility that the open call sees a different file to check permissions, to check if you can access it, than the one we actually open. Does that answer your question? So we just swap out the user ID just to do the open to make sure that the checks are done with the correct user, rather than us trying to do them. Now, you might say, this attack looks very theoretical, because we have to get super, super lucky and be able to like swap out the file while in between these two checks, this check and this open, right? That's a very short amount of time, it seems like. And it turns out that there are practical ways of making this consistent. And one example is that Unix systems commonly support symbolic links, where rather than having a directory entry pointing to a file, an inode, a directory entry will have a path to look up. And we can have very long chains of these names to look up, and that can make opening a file involve going through this long chain of things, which makes the open really, really slow. And if the open's really, really slow, we've just expanded the amount of time the open takes until it actually gets to opening the file. And using this, and also like trying to do things like, let's try to make sure that all of memory is occupied by things that aren't cached versions of the file and the directories, we can make this open extra slow and make this attack actually consistent, which was sort of a disturbing discovery, is that you can make these types of attacks sort of consistent ways to get extra privileges on a machine, even though it seems like they should be very inconsistent. And another contributing factor is that often you can set things up so you can like try 1,000 times without any penalty. Okay, so we talked about time to check time of use problems. So here, I propose some other fixes. Which of these would actually work to prevent printing our secret file? I mentioned our preferred fix is temporarily changing back to the right user. So the open call just does the check for us correctly. But which of these other fixes might actually work? Who would like some more time? Okay, who thinks A would fix the problem? Thinks A would not fix the problem? Okay, so lots of people think A would fix the problem, and A, like indeed, makes this attack not work. But there's a relatively simple way for me to make the attack work again, which is that I do the opposite operation in between the second check and the open. So I just unlink again and create a normal file in its place. So it makes the attack harder, but it doesn't get rid of the problem. So, yeah, so we can still, so this is no sort of attacker needs more steps. But can still make it so that when both of those checks happen, it's different than the file that was open. But still open a different file than was checked both times. So question, how does it make sense? So what the attack would be is that I just do these steps again after it's opened, but not linking to secret, linking to something I can actually access. Does that answer your question? So the problem is I can use the same trick that I fooled the check before to fool the check after. Yeah.
So the check that we did before was the exact same thing as option A,
except
it was just before.
Yeah. So it's the original idea. Yeah, it was just checking before. So here we're just adding a check after. We can fool that check after using the same way we fooled the check before. And I mentioned this explicitly because very, very commonly when people have a time to check or time of use bug, they try to do a fix like this, and it doesn't work. Yes, it makes the attacker work harder, but it still doesn't work. Like, they're going to be able to make, they'll just have to try a few thousand more times, but that's often not an issue. They can make that work if they can make the original attack. How about B? Who thinks B would fix the problem? B would not fix the problem? Okay, so B is actually a solution, and the reason why is yes, we're always checking the file that was opened. The same file that was opened. So we always know that the file you actually opened, we're checking the permissions on that file and not some other file. And that's because we're using the file descriptor to get it, so it must be the same thing that was opened. Like once we open a file, it doesn't change what file it's referring to. Yes?
So, the goal of this entire thing is to prevent users from opening files that they can't read.
Yeah.
So if you just let a user open a path to a file that they're not allowed to print?
Question. And B, I just let the user open a path to a file they're not allowed to print? Yes. So this is suboptimal, but we're not going to let them print it. We're just going to open it. So, yes, that could be a problem, but in this design, we're not reading from the file when we're accessing it. We're just going to open it, figure out, oh, you weren't supposed to open this, and be done. Yeah.
What if you have some other piece of code in another file that's operating in parallel, and that other piece of code reads from the file that's open?
What if I have some other code which reads from the file that's open? Why would I have that? I'm opening the file. I read all the code that uses that file descriptor as the author of the printing application. Okay, how about C? Who thinks C would fix the problem? Would not fix the problem? Okay, so it would be no, because this is in fact true in our original scenario. The user controlled the directory it's in because they could make the link. Some questions about our time to check, time of use, yes.
So the problem with C is just that you get aliasing directory to?
The problem with C is that we aliased the directory to? No, the problem with C is that in the original scenario, I controlled the directory. And we in fact know I controlled the directory because I could make a link in it. I could make an alias to another file inside that directory. I could create files in it. The problem is those files I created could be aliases of files in directories I'm not supposed to access. Yeah. Is it normal to have files you don't have access to inside a directory? It's not common, of course, in a directory that you're maintaining, but in many directories set up by the system administrator, right, there are files you can read the directory, but you don't have access to the files in there. Does that answer your question?
Absolutely.
Yeah. What's the better fix than all these? The good fix is that temporarily change the user ID. That's what you should be doing. And I'm mostly mentioning these other fixes, not because you should try to do them, but because some of these are extremely common attempts to fix this problem that people actually have done that don't work. Okay, so we'll do talk one more sort of general high-level thing about security stuff. So the sort of design we've talked about so far is something that might be known as ambient authority, that we have these user and group IDs that are assigned to a process. Those are kind of things that are just, they're part of your process, but you don't actually usually check them directly. They're there. And it's kind of on the side. Like when I call open, open knows whether I have permissions based on me running. That sort of information that's on the side. And this is sort of probably the most common approach in practice to doing sort of authorization checks, is that I have information about what stuff I'm allowed to access that's kind of metadata about my process in some way, and that's checked every time I try to access something. There's an alternate approach called capabilities, where I tie the idea of accessing things to whether I have permission. So in order to access something, I need to get a token. And the idea is, if I have that token, I have permission to access it. If I don't, I don't have permission to access it. And you can think of this token as kind of like an address for the thing. And in this design, when I want to use some object like a file, I have to supply the token for it. And the check in the kernel for what file does this token refer to is the same as the check for can you access it. And so the elegance of this design is that it's very hard for the kernel to forget to check, right? Because the check is sort of also handled by looking up what the file is. Another thing that's nice about this design is that it makes it more straightforward to say, how do I let someone else access a file I can open? I just give them the token for it, rather than needing to pass the name and make sure they have permissions to do it. If I can pass the token to them, I pass permission to access it to them. So this capabilities idea seems very much unlike what the Unix system does, with one exception. So file descriptors basically follow this capabilities model. We have a list of open files you can access, and to access an open file, you don't supply like the file name, you supply a token, which is your file descriptor. That file descriptor lets you access it, and the way the read call knows you're allowed to read is part of looking up that file descriptor proves that you're allowed to read that file. It doesn't have to do some separate check to can I read the file. That's already been done when we created this token for you. Page tables, we can think of as the same way. The token I have to access a physical page is my virtual page number, right? That's how I access it. And if a virtual page number, if it looks up to something, I have permission to access that. If it doesn't, I don't. But in this way, there's no way you can accidentally give me access to a physical page, because I can't name the physical page with a virtual page number unless, you know, it's set up in my page table. It doesn't have a token that I can use to access it. Yes? Can I give a random file descriptor and hope I access something useful? So, no. So if you remember how like XP6 stores file descriptors, we just had an array, right? And if you were, and on like the write system call, we did a lookup in that array, and if it was out of bounds of the array, we said no. If the file descriptor we looked up was not marked as for writing, it said no. And otherwise, it found out what file you were accessing. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yeah. Go back to the.
So, what do you mean by what object is this token? Like,
question, what do I mean by what object is this token? So if we think of the write system call needs to figure out what file am I writing to? And that check is, I have a file descriptor, what's the file for it? So that process is doing the can I write this file check. Rather than us, rather than say, accessing the file via a path, where we look up with the path, what file the path refers to, and then we figure out, are you allowed to access that path? So in this design, the sort of mapping from what you pass to the operation to accessing the thing, that does the authorization check. Sort of just inherently. Does that answer your question? Question with file descriptors. You know, with file descriptors, we're looking up that file descriptor in a list. And if something's in the list, you can access it, right, for your process. And if something's not, you can't.
In this case, we just don't have that. The process of accessing it, the ability to access it, it's
question. In this case, we don't have that. So with file descriptors, we do have this property. Right, but if we're, like, for example, opening a file with a path, we don't have the property, right? I can name lots of files I'm not supposed to access. But as far as writing files with the write system call, I can't specify the file I want to write to if I don't have it open. And that's what makes this sort of check, you know, more elegant in a sense, because it's very hard for me to accidentally make the write system call implementation I make allow you to write to files that you don't have permission to open. So in this sort of design, we have these lists of things that processes can access kind of stored with the process. And sort of the handle to access the object is a key in this permitted object table. And so that sort of this idea is known as capabilities. And now, then there's a question of like, how do I get objects in the first place? And there's sort of a couple ways that this can happen. So one is that we can have them inherited when you fork. When you fork a program, you inherit all the open files. So you're inheriting that same list of things you can access. And the same thing is true for like page table entries, for physical pages. So one way we can pass files in this mechanism is with that. But we need to worry about, what about, you know, accessing other files? Because a problem with this design is that if I want to use this for like opening files instead of just file descriptors, I need to have a way of not specifying a path, but specifying a token. How do I get that token? And one thing we can do which might help is that maybe we could have a way of passing these tokens between processes. And in fact, Unix commonly supports this, a way of passing file descriptors over a local socket to support this kind of thing. That rather than telling a process, open this file with this path, I could say, I opened the file, let me pass you a file descriptor, and there's a special, and there's a way of passing it through a socket. Where the OS will handle adding an entry to your processes table for the file descriptor that was sent to you, rather than passing a file name. But it's a little tricky to think about what capabilities look like without sort of looking at a more maybe complete example. So as an example, talk about what a research project did for capabilities, where they tried to do capabilities for more than just file descriptors and page tables. They tried to like make all the Unix things use capabilities. And then there's this kind of an opt-in thing where processes could set themselves up to only use capabilities, not use any stuff that like involves access control lists. And this meant that they needed to have tokens to access things besides just files and physical memory. And so what they decided to do is that they just made file descriptors for more than just files. They made file descriptors for directories, file descriptors for processes. And so our list of file descriptors referred to sort of all the things we could access. And they also had the file descriptors, rather than specifying whether it was open for reading or writing, it also specified it could be open for like executing, for killing, for a process file descriptor, and so on. And in this design, they said, we're not going to have, when you opt in, anything where we sort of have sort of global data. You're always going to figure out how to access something using one of your capabilities, using one of your tokens. So you might say, what does that mean for like opening a file in a directory? Well, what you'll get is you'll get a capability for the directory, and there'll be a way of saying, using that directory, open something inside it. So an open at system call that takes a directory and looks up something inside there. And that's how you access something in a directory. So there's no notion of like slash of the root directory. Instead, you just have a capability that is the set of files you can access. And if I pass you one set of files, that's the set of files you can access. You can't name files that are outside of that set. For executing files, you can open a file and you can execute it with a file descriptor. They just added a system call to do that. And for forking, we didn't have process IDs because I can guess the process ID of any process. They instead had this fork that returns a process file descriptor, and there's a way of killing a particular process or with that file descriptor. So rather than being able to like kill any process, you can only kill processes you have a token for. You have one of these capabilities for. So that's sort of the practical mapping they chose. So questions on capabilities? So the idea of capabilities is avoiding doing sort of external verification? Yeah, so that's sort of the idea is that at least the kernel part of the system, all it does is it looks up what is this token refer to. And you might say, well, how do we interact that with like access control lists? And there's multiple ideas. So one idea is that you could still use access control lists and capabilities. Another is that you could like have a server you contact that like hands out tokens. And it could enforce whatever rules it wants. So like if you open a file, you could have like a server you contact which on the local machine where you say, hey, I'd like to open this file, and it looks up who you are and gives you a token for that file if it wants to. Is that, yeah. Isn't it possible to just brute force search for the token? So in this scheme, the token is valid because it's in an array stored with your process. And I mentioned sending tokens between processes. So what this will do is the OS will add to your array when you receive the token. That's how that works. So you aren't making up the number. Like the OS assigns a number when it receives when you make this call to get a copy of token from someone else. Does that answer your question? Yes. Other questions? Nope. Yeah. So Yeah, so as I mentioned, like with this design, you could do something like have some server which like can does some access control list stuff, but you could still use this for the kernel, and the kernel might not deal with that. That would be a common sort of implementation idea with this design. And the hope is that it makes all these sort of kernel checks a lot simpler. Some other questions? Yeah. Question no PIDs instead of FDs. So with normal fork, you can do like PID equals fork, and then you can like kill PID. But the problem is that I can also like do kill and make up any processor number and kill it. The idea with PD fork is that I can only call, the only way I'm going to be able to kill a process is if I have it's a file descriptor for it. I'm not going to be able to use a process ID that's the same everywhere. And whether or not I have a process file descriptor is whether or not I can kill it. Question, is calling PD fork to return a file descriptor? Yes. Yeah, and that file descriptor is how you would kill that process. You can't kill it with its process ID in this design. Other questions? Okay, so in our last 15 minutes, I'll do my super brief talk about how virtual machines work. And we're gonna talk about system virtual machines. So in a system virtual machine, we're rather than providing some convenient system call interface that we've talked about for the rest of the semester, we're implementing the hardware interface. And it has to be some hardware, it might not be real hardware, but it's gonna be some hardware that's easy to emulate. And the idea is that we're gonna run an operating system that's meant to be running on real hardware. And to do this, we're gonna have what I'll call a hypervisor or virtual machine monitor, the program that runs virtual machines. And it's gonna be running a guest OS, an operating system that's inside the virtual machine. And it's gonna be running on top on a host OS, the thing that runs the hypervisor. And sometimes the hypervisor will be the OS, and it might be easier to think of things that way, even though, yes, in practice, when we run a hypervisor, often it's kind of, we have a normal OS, but somehow the hypervisor gets enough access to do everything it needs to do. And we talked about imitating the hardware interface. And if we look at actual virtual machines that are out there, you might think, okay, so that means that when a guest OS is running, it looks exactly the same as some real physical machine. And sometimes that's true, and sometimes it's not. So there's sort of different degrees of virtualization that are done. So there's something called full virtualization where we actually make it look like real hardware, where our guest OS doesn't do anything different because it's running in a virtual machine. It might not look like any a combination of real hardware that's really unusual, but it will look like real hardware. There's something called paravirtualization where we say, well, gosh, it turns out full virtualization is really hard. So why don't we just add a few little things to the OS to make it easier. And this idea is called paravirtualization. So here, we'll change little things in the OS to make our virtual machine more efficient or simpler. And a common example would be you might change how page table entries are set, because it turns out that that's really inefficient to deal with if you're doing full virtualization. And it's usually pretty easy to find all the places in the OS where you set page table entries and make them change how that works, make them do something slightly different so the hypervisor knows what's going on. And I'm using these terms. These terms are kind of fuzzy in practice because some people will say custom device drivers, that's still full virtualization, even though this device driver would never work on physical hardware. And some people say, well, that's power virtualization. I'm not gonna care, I'm just gonna tell you that there's a dispute on whether which is which. So I'm gonna talk about implementing virtual machines without special hardware support and running the guest OS sort of directly on the hardware, kind of like when we run a user program, like we just execute its instructions on the real processor. We're gonna do the same thing for the guest OS. I'm gonna mention that this is not the only way of implementing virtual machines. So very commonly, there's extra hardware support for virtual machines. I'm not going to talk about that. And another idea is that we can compile the guest OS to new machine code. That might sound crazy complicated, but this is really how some virtual machine monitors work. But we're going to talk about the simple way where we're just going to run the guest OS instructions directly on the real processor. So in this idea, we have our guest OS running some program. It's running the guest OS on the guest OS, which is running on our hypervisor, our virtual machine implementation. And we're going to run the hypervisor code, at least some of it, in kernel mode. And the guest OS is all going to run in user mode. But the guest OS is going to be think it's going to run in kernel mode. So we're going to have sort of a pretend kernel mode and a pretend user mode. And the hypervisor is going to track, you know, everything we track for a normal process. So we're going to track in the guest OS what the registers are, what the page table is, what physical pages are they can access, what I/O devices there are, open files, sort of just accessed in a different way. So same things as a normal process. And we're also going to track stuff to implement this idea of a pretend kernel mode. So we're going to track, does the guest OS think it's running in kernel mode, or does it think it's running in user mode? And that's how we're going to implement this idea of pretend kernel mode and pretend user mode. So when the guest OS does something, we know, do I want to act as if it's in kernel mode or if it's in user mode? And we'll also have extra state related to kernel mode. So we're going to implement the things that the processor would do in kernel mode. And one of those things is going to be like page tables. So we're going to have our own notion of what the guest OS thinks its page table pointer is. And as a hypervisor implementer, we're going to track that. The guest OS has exceptions. We're going to have to track what the guest OS thinks its exception table is so we can implement exceptions for the guest OS. Because we're implementing the kernel functionality now to implement this idea of this pretend kernel mode. Even though the way we're implementing it is by running the code in user mode and doing the things the processor would do, like jump to an exception. So let's talk about sort of the basic idea of how we're going to, implement that pretend kernel mode functionality. So normally, the guest OS is going to do something privileged, like it's going to access some device memory, or it's going to try to change the exception table. But we're going to run it in user mode, so those operations aren't allowed. So what's going to happen? It's going to trigger an exception. And in normal OS, when that exception occurs, you're going to say, gosh, you just tried to access memory for this device. Or you just tried to change the exception table. Programs aren't allowed to do that, and we'll crash the program. With our hypervisor, what we're going to do instead is we're going to say, well, what was the guest OS trying to do? And we're going to try to simulate that operation, assuming the guest OS was in this pretend kernel mode. If the guest OS was in the pretend user mode, what are we going to do? We're going to say, gosh, you were running a user program in our guest OS. We should tell the guest OS that this program did something it wasn't supposed to do by triggering the same exception. So how do we sort of do the actual privileged operation? So what will happen is we'll have our guest OS running in pretend kernel mode, and let's say it tries to print something to the screen. The way we do that, remember, is we write to these special memory addresses. So what we'll do is when that exception happens, we will get an exception in our hypervisor. And our hypervisor is going to say, okay, you wanted to write something to the screen. Let me do that for you. And then it's going to switch back to the OS after it does that, just after it simulates that operation. Some questions about this sort of idea? Yeah. Question, why does the hypervisor have any user mode stuff? So in practice, there would be some user mode stuff. The part we're talking about likely is mostly in kernel mode. And the reason it's likely mostly in kernel mode is because it has to deal with catching these exceptions. So it has to have some way of getting these exceptions when the guest OS tries to do something that normally would trigger a crash. Does that answer your question? Other questions? So what would this sort of code that does this operation look like? And we'll talk about doing this for like a keyboard read. So what we'll do is we'll have our exception handler, like trap in XV6, and we're gonna say, oh, was the OS trying to do a read from the keyboard? Maybe we can like look at the instruction that was running and say, is this a read from keyboard instruction? And then we'll do a read system call based on how it was trying to read from the keyboard. So, like, for example, we would say, okay, you know, if was, so more precisely, like, remember that reading from a keyboard in XV6 involved this special in instruction. So what we might do is we might say, okay, there was a protection fault. The guest OS thinks it's in kernel mode. You know, it thinks it's running kernel code. So we're going to see, was it an in instruction, one of those instructions to read from the device? If so, where was it trying to access? Was it trying to access the keyboard? If so, let's do a read system call for it. Let's store the result of that read system call in the register the in instruction was writing to. In this case, it would be AL. And let's advance to the next instruction and return from our exception handler. So basically, we're emulating the instruction. We're doing all the steps the processor would do. But rather than talking to the device directly, we're doing what a read system call would do, but we're putting the result back the same way the processor would put the result back of, you know, talking to the keyboard. And we advance to the next instruction. So when we return from this exception, we don't try to do that instruction again, we just go on to the next thing. And the guest OS runs as if this in instruction actually read from the keyboard and set the register it was trying to read into. So this is a way we can implement virtual machines. You'll note that we have to do some pretty annoying stuff, like parsing instructions, which maybe is not super efficient. So maybe there's some ways the hardware can help us with this to make this easier, but this is at least a practical way of implementing virtual machines without any special hardware support. This trap and emulate idea. So questions? Yeah. What I mean by actually talk to the device? So in this example, what I do is I say, oh, you mentioned read from the keyboard, let me do a system call to actually do that read. Right, so we're gonna do the actual operation of reading from the keyboard on its behalf. That might be done in a different way though, right? Maybe our virtual machine is taking its input from the network and not from a real keyboard, that's okay. But we're gonna do some equivalent operation on its behalf to get its result.
So this code is in the hypervisor?
Question, this code is in the hypervisor, yes. Yeah.
Does it mean the guest operating system can see everything on the host operating system?
Question, does it mean the guest operating system can see everything on the host operating system? No. The guest operating system is running like a process would in the host operating system and has the same sort of access, right? It's whatever the system calls, and in this case, all the exception handlers we implement let it do. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so I showed you sort of the case where, you know, we have an exception because the guest OS was trying to do some instruction to access a device, and we just simulate what that instruction would do, but, you know, get the data for it from wherever we want to. In this case, it thought it's reading from a keyboard, maybe we simulate that keyboard with something else. Another case we have to deal with is that if the guest OS thinks it's running in user mode, we don't want to actually pretend to read from the device, we want to run the guest exception handler. So what we're gonna do is, if the guest OS thinks it's in user mode, we're just going to jump to the guest OS's exception and mark it as thinking it's in kernel mode, which is simulating exactly what guest OS would do. And that's my I think I'm out of time. So that's my very brief introduction to the simplest way of implementing virtual machines. There's obviously a lot more we could talk about there, but that's where we'll finish up for, I guess, this semester. So next time, I'm going to do, as it says on the schedule, final exam review. The way that's going to work is I'm going to answer your questions about topics you'd like me to talk about. If you don't have any questions, it will be a very short class.